Okay, we're going to get started. Good afternoon. We have a lengthy agenda this afternoon. So we'll start out with the approval of the agenda. Is there a motion to approve the agenda? Is there a second? Second. All in favor of approving the agenda, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. We'll move to approve the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Is there a second? Second. Minutes are before us. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Okay, now we'll go back. We have a lengthy agenda, so I'd like to do a quick overview of the items before turning it over to our CFO and his staff to guide us through the items. First on our agenda is a request to approve the establishment of a trust for other post-employment benefit items, such as retiree health care and prescription drug coverage and life insurance. This trust will provide more sustainable funding to meet OPED obligations and will follow up on the board's authorization of the trust in 2009 and including funding for the trust in the FY 2015 and 2016 budget. I also know that our board member, Mr. Bulger, here would like to discuss the board's role as, quote, plan sponsor during this discussion. And when we get there, the Maryland delegation would like to discuss postponing this item to our next meeting, so we'll get there when we get there. Next, the committee will be asked to amend the capital budget to accept grant money from the Department of Homeland Security for new cameras at 7 Metro Rail stations, integrate existing cameras into the electronic safety and security system, and support additional risk assessment and security planning efforts. The committee will also hear several informational presentations today to assist us in our oversight role and in planning for next year's budget. First, Ms. Moore McGee will provide an overview of the results of Metro's most recent employee engagement survey, which is designed to identify employee issues and concerns and identify Metro's strengths and opportunities for improvement. Mr. Fishburne will update us on Metro's continued progress in addressing issues raised by the FTA's Financial Management Oversight Report. And Mr. Anisite and Mr. Troop provide us with a fiscal year-end report on the FY 2015 budget, which ended on June 30th. Finally, our CFO will begin preliminary discussions with the board on the FY 2017 budget. I will note that this is a follow-up to our strategic plan discussions we had this summer. It's also a month earlier than would normally take place. So with that, I'll turn the discussion over to our CFO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, we will try to be as brief as possible. And with that, I will remind the committee that this particular agenda item was first brought to this board on June earlier this year. And so at that point, it was deferred due to questions raised by the board. Among those questions were with respect to the various trusts that the authority have. And so today, in addition to the resolution, we will be spending some time discussing the various trusts. With respect to the trust, WMATA has 9 separate trusts. 5 of those trusts are for defined pension plans, and 2 are for defined contributions plans, as well as an additional 2, which are health care trusts. Overall, those were established a long time ago, and they serve specific purposes based on the IRS regulations. In accordance with those IRS regulations, these trusts have separate trustees who have fiduciary obligations to those various plans. The first and perhaps the biggest one is the 689 plan, which is 72% funded at this particular point. This particular fund has $2.3 billion in terms of assets, as well as 6 trustees, 3 of whom are management and 3 of whom are union. And at the end of this presentation, we will try to summarize that for you. The next trust is Local 922. Again, it's 92% funded with assets of $162 million. Again, it has four trustees, some of whom are management and some of whom are union. The next one is Local 2, which is 82% funded with an asset value of $125 million. And then you have FOP, which is 74% funded with assets of $165 million. The last defined benefit plan is the non-represented. This plan is now closed. It's currently 73% funded with $355 million in assets, and again has trustees that include both management and union. With respect to the other one, as I mentioned earlier, there are two plans that are defined contribution plans, the 401A and the 457. Again, the 401A serves as a replacement for those employees who were prior participants after 1999, I believe, in the non-rep plan. With that closure, there needed to be another source of retirement plan for them, and this is what the 401A serves. The 457 serves as the depository for the management match to those plans. Now we get to OPEB. With respect to OPEB and the trust that's being proposed, as we indicated last time, WMATA currently has a $1.5 billion unfunded liability with respect to OPEB. And as most of the jurisdictions have done, the idea here, which the board agreed to a couple of years ago, is to identify a fund dedicated specifically for payment of those future contributions, but still having those funds available to meet immediate OPEB obligations should we choose to do that. And that's what this fund does. And if it's funded, at least as suggested to this board, and based on this board's agreement a few years ago, the incremental funding was supposed to generate about $50 million by 2040 and allow to grow, will allow this organization to address those liabilities. But in addition to the OPEB fund, WMATA has actually taken several steps already, one of which was to eliminate post-retirement health care from future employees. Obviously, our current employees are excluded from that cover, as well as also using a benefits manager, which I understand went into effect earlier this year. Now, this board has indicated in the past an interest in getting clarity on what's going on and obviously some suggestions, and currently we provide to the board on a quarterly basis a report on the performance of the plans. But as we've heard in the past, to the extent that the board wants to do other stuff, this is the time to do that. With that, I'll stop this at this point and go to a slide which I'm told needs to be discussed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Bolger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For some time, many of you know, and I'll be short, devoted some time and effort to try to figure out what the board's situation is regarding what Dennis just described. This chart that I bring your attention to, the second to last number on the right, unfunded liability, and this has nothing to do with the OPEB unfunded liability, but this focus on the $1.18 billion. We all got a memo that I never saw back on July 3rd, 2014. That was a good one because I think we were all on 4th of July vacation or something that sort of laid out what this board's responsibilities are. And as Dennis pointed out, we do not have fiduciary responsibility over the trustees of all of the pension funds that Dennis talked about. However, we are the plan sponsor of all of these pension funds. So I'm going to propose for discussion today that the committee consider a pension subcommittee. And what I mean by that would be the subcommittee would initially have a work program. They'd have some principles to work from. And I'm looking to figure out and understand the governing process of the defined benefit pension plans, the one defined contribution retirement plan, and the deferred compensation plan for its various employees. The subcommittee would identify and disclose the leadership structure of the WMATA pension plans, including the fiduciary principles and the selection and monitoring of trustees. The subcommittee would examine trustee attributes and core competencies, including ongoing trustee education policies, disclosures of trustees' ethics and conflicts of interest, including, and that would be verified. I'm also suggesting that the committee have regular, at least semi-annual or annual meetings with the trustees pertaining to the pension fund's performance, asset allocation, investment policies, actuarial policies, benefits administration, open meeting and public records, financial controls and audits, and how they're selecting vendors to guide to try to bring that $1.8 billion unfunded liability down over the course of X number of years. So I open up the discussion about that idea. I hope we could have a discussion, maybe not today, Mr. Chairman, but just for the next meeting. I know we have a lot of time, but I want to put that into the record and have it calendared appropriately.
Okay. Well, why don't we discuss it now? Anybody have any comments on this? I happen to think it's a good idea. I don't know if anybody else does or doesn't. Mort, what do you think?
You look at the long-term sustainability of this entity, and down the road, we've got some big obligations coming due. Pensions have to be paid when people retire. Currently, structured benefit programs like medical benefits for future retirees can eat us alive in the future. The more we can do to get those things funded now and to do it efficiently and effectively, this is kind of the below-the-radar screen stuff that's going on that actually makes a big difference in terms of doing our work as stewards of this organization. It's something we can't just ignore.
So, go ahead, somebody else. Corbett?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I concur also, and from a good governance point of view, it's appropriate for us to have a committee looking over the pensions, how they're invested, returns, and things of that nature. And you'll find that most boards across the country will have something like that. So I concur.
So given my impatient nature of doing things, is there a way we could do this right now, set it up and be ready to go, or do we have to wait?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would just suggest you have the capacity, the chairman of the board has the capacity under the bylaws to set up any kind of subcommittee, so does the chairman of each committee. I think you might want to figure out who's on it and bring it to the board meeting in 2 weeks and set the committee up.
Okay, great idea.
I'd follow the bylaws.
Huh? Yeah, okay.
Just follow the bylaws.
I would also suggest this subcommittee may want professional advice in terms of an overall view of pensions, of investment policies and the like. I know other boards that I'm on, we have that and benefit to oversee the other managers and create some benchmarks as to what their performance should be. But I think that would be for the committee to work through.
Well, I intended to try to maybe work with Mark to try to work with plans established
board meeting and have a little more meat on the bone.
Okay, great. Why don't you just get something and work with Mary and Mort or whoever knows stuff about this? Okay, good. And so we'll bring it back to us and Mort, you can act on it in 2 weeks. Is that right? All right, makes sense. Okay, all right. Are we still on this or are we done with this? Okay, now we have to go to Mike. Mike,
right.
Now,
Mr. Chairman,
let me just say one thing first. We're going to be in disagreement, so I think we should move ahead because I really want to address this. Now, Mike came to me, and I appreciate that saying that Marilyn wants, and I want to accommodate you, so go ahead, tell us why.
Marilyn would appreciate putting off this discussion until the next meeting of the Finance Administration Committee because this, I guess Marilyn still has some concerns about this. I guess our concerns, in a nutshell, are we think that there's more important things for the CFO and his staff to be doing right now than to be setting up this trust. You know, we have still responses to the FTA's federal management audit. You heard more about that in the single audit report this morning from the outside auditors. You know, and we still have to work towards completing a audit for the FY15 year, the year that we just completed. And so we think as a best use of the board's resources that going into it, setting this up right now, is not the best thing to do. Second of all, since we're only talking about a small amount of money, $4 million right now, and maybe another $11 million that would be due for this fiscal year, FY16, that we have time to decide to actually set up this trust, set up the trustees, and get all that mechanism started. And so we would ask that the issue be deferred for 1 month so that the CFO can confer with the district CFO and the Maryland CFO and see if they can come to some meeting of the minds as to when. If you guys are interested in this issue, absolutely.
We are the people who've been pushing to establish this trust from the very beginning, Mr. Goldman.
That's why,
goodness
that's
gracious.
That's why your CFO should be
involved. We should have done this a year ago. This is ridiculous.
Well, and we think it's ridiculous to do it right this minute. So there's where we are. So rather than let's all the CFOs talk and see if they can come to a meeting of the minds rather than wasting a lot of time
Mort?
At a meeting today.
And I agree. Our CFO has lots of important things to do.
This is important.
This, is, to me, is one of them. This
yes.
is, again, a long-term obligation that won't get any smaller if we aren't putting some investments in place to pay for that. But I would think we should give the direction to the CFO that this is what the board wants done, but he should do it in good time, and along with all the other responsibilities on his back. I don't think we should just month to month to month postpone doing something that's really important to do.
Well, I'm prepared to go forward and vote to do it today. Mike, you guys, I don't know, do you have is there a jurisdictional veto in the FISC, not in the committee? So it's like everybody who's sitting here can vote, and then the majority passes. Does anybody else have any comments on it before we move forward or not move forward? I mean, I'm prepared to wait a month, but I will say if we wait a month, I'm going to vote on it in a month. I don't want to wait 2 months. Mary, your point is well taken. This has been kicking out there forever, and I don't agree with. You see, what my concern is this is always easy money to go to at the end of the day when you need money. And this organization does it. You know, it was supposed to be funded at a much higher number, and we didn't do it because we needed the money. The reason the District of Columbia is 100% funded in our pensions is we have a federal law that mandates it, and a ton of federal money. And if we didn't have a federal law that mandated it, I can assure you my colleagues would be raiding the fund every day. Every day. So it's 101. But we need that. We need that. Otherwise, you know, we're all going to be lining up to take the money when we is it going to be raising fares or take the money out of the pension fund? You know, we'll take the money out of the pension fund. So that's why I think this is so important. What does anybody else think? Drive the discussion here.
Well, Jack, all the research that I've been doing on this pension issue that I've been working on for 2 years, this is the wrong thing to do, period. Is it the most conservative writers about pension reform will all tell you that this is the wrong thing to not take this off the table. It will catch up to you. Maybe we won't be on this board. It's going to catch up to this organization.
Kathy, what do you think? Virginia, what do you think?
And when we get to the budget discussion, there's also a whole set of recommendations that are there to begin to diminish this exposure.
Right.
But funding it, regardless of what it's diminished to, is still going to be an obligation. Pay me now or pay me a lot more later.
I have no problem with deferring it. I don't think that it says that we don't meet our obligation. And I do believe that we have at many occasions attempted to try and get here. I think the last steps that we made are demonstrated by that. If you think it will bring you back to the table in a month, I'm willing to be back at the table in a month. I think we do have an agenda that's really chock full of responsibilities. So I don't have a problem with your motion, and I'd be willing to support it. That does not mean that we do not pay attention to it. And I think we have been focused on that for more recent years.
Anybody else?
I think the conversation among the CFOs would be helpful. they can bring us to a consensus if we're putting it off for 30 days and trying to deal with it with a better knowledge base and hopefully a consensus by early next month. That's all I have.
All right. What does everybody think? Nobody else has anything to say? Corbett, what do you think? 30 days?
In all respect, in terms of harmony here, I think that perhaps we could wait for 30 days. It's not the end of the world. Hopefully not. Okay.
All right, Mike, here's the message to take back. At least this is my personal message. I'm speaking for the group. This will be back on the agenda in 30 days, and I'm going to bring it to a vote because I want to move forward with this. And hopefully we can work something out between now and then. But the idea of just not doing it is not something that I support.
You have a message that you see, Mr. Chairman.
All right. All right, moving along.
Good afternoon. I'm Tom Webster, Managing Director of Management Budget here at Metro. The Department of Homeland Security has awarded Metro a $4.3 million Transit Security Program grant for security-related projects. Today's staff seeks committee approval of an amendment to the budget and to this FY16-21 Capital Improvement Program in order to accept that grant award and implement the projects. Over the past several years, through Department of Homeland Security grants and other funding sources, Metro has deployed a state-of-the-art electronic safety and security system that includes a network of cameras, video management system, and a new security operation control center. Actually, earlier today, Metro received the formal award letter for the $4.3 million grant that will support two projects. $2.9 million for a capital project to install new cameras at seven additional stations and to integrate those cameras into the electronic safety and security system, and a $1.4 million for ongoing risk assessment and security planning efforts that are advanced by Metro Transit Police. The DHS Security Grant Program does not require direct matching funds from Metro. However, there are additional costs that Metro must incur to implement the projects, including approximately $1.2 million of one-time capital labor and support costs, as well as approximately $125,000 in annual operating and maintenance costs to support the camera systems once they're installed. So through this item, staff also seeks committee approval of an amendment to the capital program to shift $1.2 million of non-federal sources from a bus repairables project to support the implementation of the security camera. The cost of these projects will not require additional jurisdictional operating or subsidy or capital contributions in FY16. So staff recommends that the committee approve the proposed resolution to amend and increase the FY16-21 capital improvement program by $2.9 million and the FY16 operating reimbursable budget by $1.4 million in order to accept the grant and implement the projects. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, the resolution before us, is there any discussion? Anyone?
Move.
All right, seconded. All right, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. Okay, now we have a number of informational discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As some of you might remember, in September of 2012, WMATA decided to take a comprehensive approach to measure key aspects of the workplace environment and worked with the Hay Company to conduct an employee opinion survey, which included measuring employee engagement and enablement, performance management, leadership, as well as our progress on efforts to improve our safety culture. In 2012, the results identified what our employees felt were our strengths as well as opportunities for improvement. This established a baseline from which we could identify employee issues and concerns and began to develop action plans to develop them at multiple levels throughout the organization, to build organization leadership capability and use employee feedback to drive performance and track performance over time. A commitment was made to conduct successive employee surveys planned for 2014, 16, and 18. Today, we'd like to share with you the results of the most recent employee feedback. In a moment, I will introduce you to Dr. Hazen Wintermeyer of the Hay Group, who will review with you the results of the 2014 survey, and how those compared with what our employees told us in 2012, as well as how the organization compares with the U.S. norm. Afterwards, I will share with you some of the initiatives we have undertaken, as well as action planning currently underway. Dr. Wintermeyer's corporate experience includes driving enterprise-level organizational change and cultural transformation efforts anchored in employee feedback. She holds a master's and bachelor's in English, bachelor's in mathematics, and her doctoral dissertation featured original research on employee engagement, conceptualization, and measurement. Dr. Wintermeyer.
Thank you for the opportunity to present today and share with you the feedback from employees during the most recent WMATA employee engagement survey. The survey took place from October 27th to November 21 of last year, comprised a 61-question instrument, including an open-ended comment field. It was offered both online and via paper administration, and we saw a 68% overall response rate, which in a population with a high paper percentage is quite good. It was also a four-point improvement from 2012. In terms of what the data show us, 54% of employees are both engaged, meaning they are committed and motivated by the organization, as well as enabled, which means that they are positioned to perform in terms of being in roles that are challenging and interesting, as well as in a supportive work environment. Overall, this is a very strong score. It is several points above the U.S. norm of 51% of engagement and enablement, as well as approaching the high-performing benchmark. High-performing benchmark is comprised of pay group companies who have both excellent performance in terms of engagement and enablement, as well as performance in key indicators such as return on investment, return on assets, return on equity, et cetera. We saw an improvement in employee engagement of 2 points year over year. Again, for an organization the size of Metro, this is a substantial improvement. And employee enablement levels were consistent with 2012. Areas where there were meaningful improvements statistically included quality of transit services, teamwork within groups, pay and benefits, and performance management. In addition, stable performance was recorded in areas focused on from 2012, including trust and confidence in leadership, respect and appreciation, and cross-organizational collaboration. Next slide. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the data slides so that we have opportunity for questions as we go, but this chart shows the breakdown of the employee population according to engagement and enablement. This is a Hay Group framework, which helps us identify where opportunities for long-term and short-term action planning can exist. As I mentioned before, we saw 54% of the Metro population in that highly effective bucket, which is approaching the high-performing organization's norm as well as ahead of the U.S. norm. We go to the next slide. Here we have a summary of the dimensions or categories of the employment experience that we measured, including a comparator column versus 2012. We saw very favorable results in strategy and mission and employee engagement, followed closely by safety, and moderately favorable mixed results in the remaining categories. Again, some substantial improvements in terms of pay and benefits and resources and relatively stable performance across the remainder of the dimensions. Next slide. Based on our work with organizations globally and in the U.S. in a variety of different industry sectors, public sector, private sector, we evaluated the data and looked at strengths and opportunities. As I mentioned before, strategy and mission, so having a clear understanding of where the organization is headed and why, is a strength in the Metro employee population. The safety item here talks about high scores in training and communications around safety. And how we interpret this is that overall, Metro has been making progress up to the point of the 2014 survey in instilling a safety culture, putting some support mechanisms in place to promote that agenda. Further development and advancement opportunities are perceived fairly strongly at Metro. two areas of opportunity can include customer service. Employees consistently want to be able to do more and support customers better, as well as leadership and communications. Trust and confidence in leaders remained an opportunity area relative to our external benchmarks and comparators. Next slide. Quickly here, a few items on safety. We recognize that this has been a top-of-mind issue and wanted to provide you with some data. As noted before, some very strong scores in terms of training and communications around safety. Next slide. With that, I'm going to turn it back to Tanya to talk a little bit about how the organization is responding to this data.
As was done with the 2012 employee opinion survey, the leadership team has communicated the 2014 results to our employees through various meetings. We facilitated focus groups with our employees to allow us to dig deeper into the survey results in order to gain a better perspective of what the feedback is telling us and what our employees are expecting us to do about it. There are several agency-wide initiatives that have already been implemented and a number that are underway based on the feedback. An agency-wide Years of Service Recognition Program was launched in November of 2014. It is designed to consistently and formally honor employees throughout the authority for the years of service. And as you may recall, those with 40 or more years of service have been honored at the board meeting. Within the customer care program, which we briefed on earlier today, a new agency-wide customer care employee recognition initiative was recently launched where employees are eligible to receive monthly, quarterly, and annual awards for customer service excellence. Principles of supervision for the leadership course, personal supervisors, which was piloted in 2014 and fully launched this year. It's a scenario-based program with 50-plus individual vignettes that will model supervisors and talent on a daily basis. It has experiential learning format addressing the network business policies, procedures, regulatory environments, and many of the activities and responsibilities of that group. A new succession planning pilot program was recently launched. Metro Lead is a new leadership development program that we are currently developing, consisting of dedicated programs targeting five levels within the organization. Those levels are for emerging supervisors, first-level supervisors, our superintendents, assistant general superintendents and managers, our general superintendents and directors, as well as our executive leadership team. Additionally, survey analysts are trained and have assisted the individual departments across Metro with facilitated listening sessions, also drilled down to the feedback of their specific employees. All groups with 10 or more employees or offices, you're able to drill down on the results of that specific group so that you can better understand, because the issues across the organization are not necessarily all the same. As a result, departments have created and continue to cultivate ongoing action plans based on that feedback. They include things like departmental recognition programs for things such as innovation, customer service, whether it's internal or external customers, as well as collaboration. All hands meetings are being held. Gap analysis and needs assessments have been designed, are designed to include technical training and expand professional development opportunities. There have been the establishment of cross-functional teams to re-engineer and document processes and develop standard operating procedures. Development of more effective and robust communications within departments and team building. On September 1st, the general manager kicked off the first of what would be a series of leadership summits for the executive and senior management team. To accelerate understanding, support, and efficacy of the leadership cultural change required to reaffirm priorities, identify unique strengths and opportunities, patterns and trends, and develop action plans to address the areas of concern. In closing, I would say it's our intent to engage with our employees on an ongoing basis and have dialogue with them on our action plans, activities, initiatives, and as a direct result of their feedback, because we understand how vitally important it is that they know we're listening and not only listening but responding to what they're telling us. And at this time, I do have any questions.
Okay, thank you for your excellent report. Questions from members of the committee?
Yes, Mr. Thanks for the report. I just think maybe this report should have been connected to the agenda item we had at customer service. And maybe there's a cross-fertilization that we should should have with this other staff. Tanya, I don't know. What do you think? An observation.
Mort?
Yeah, I would just make the same comment vis-a-vis the safety committee. That this tells us, in many respects, what we're doing and where we can improve on it. I mean, it was good news. I did have one question for Dr. Whittemeyer.
Yes.
When you make these assessments of engaged employees, perfect employees, I assume that's not they check the box and said I'm an engaged employee, but it's rather their answers to particular questions that are indicators of engagement?
Yes. We've been doing employee survey research for over 40 years at Hay Group, and we have a validated instrument that we use to measure employee engagement that comprises 5 items to measure both organizational commitment as well as intention to expend discretionary effort.
So when we know now that we have potentially an engaged workforce, in some respects it's our responsibility to engage them in going forward on what the mission is.
Yes, and our framework. I'm sorry. Our framework also indicates a number of the factors in the employment experience that our research shows to consistently drive engagement and higher levels of engagement, including things like confidence in leadership and other factors that we looked at in that dimension summary chart.
Mary?
Thanks very much. I always find employee surveys fascinating on multiple dimensions. I would note that this one was done between October 27th and November 2nd, so almost a year ago. A lot has happened in a year. And I note, Tanya, that you just had a meeting last week of your senior leaders. And I don't know if you're picking up anything that you think the board should be aware of from employees around some of these issues, given where we are a year later. But I guess my request would be that the board be aware, be made aware in some manner of if you are sensing significant issues around either engagement or empowerment. That's the other one.
Enablement.
Enablement. In our sort of rank and file folks, because I think that really does matter in an organization like this, and I think we would be silly to think that some of the changes that have happened at the upper levels and on the board are not having some level of effect on how employees view working here. So I, for one, would be interested in understanding any insights you all might have.
Yes, thank you for that question. Obviously, if we took that survey today, the results might be a little bit differently. It's simply a snapshot in time. That's the thing that the leadership team is working on at this point. How do we do that, and how do we work on it, both from the top and from the bottom, to talk to our employees at the departmental level and to start addressing the issues that they're bringing to our attention?
Kathy.
When I looked at this, I'm sure other people did too, I was struck by the fact that you're seeing more engagement and more enablement on the safety issue, whereas we've had at least fairly recently one significant safety lapse. And I understand the difference in time periods. But it also makes me think, and perhaps this question is more addressed to Mr. Troop than anyone else, is that with safety, it's not enough to get the average employee, you know, to be more safe. You have to worry about the extremes at the bottom. You have to worry about the individual lapses. And I wonder, as a manager, how you manage safety when it's not just a question of getting your average employee to be more conscious of it, but it's a question of getting those people at the bottom of the tier to stop, you know, making big mistakes.
And thank you for that question. And in automatic train control, which you know, that's what my discipline is in, we have an expression which is 100%, 100% of the time. We cannot fail in automatic train control. You know, that's not an option to be able to do that. We need people to be engaged all the time, 100%, whether they're making circuit checks, whether they're doing safety verifications, whatever they're doing, they need to be 100%, 100% of the time. So the way that you do that is, let me take an example for the red signal violations. It's not enough simply to throw a rule at a person and say, "This is you have violated the red signal. You know, this is the rule. You should not do that." We need to understand the context around which these violations are being done so we can get the broader sense of the population of what is happening. You know, what is the What are the psychological influences that are created for somebody to do that? What are the circumstances behind it? What are they looking at? So it's going a lot deeper than just simply the application of the rule. It's being able to define, you know, on a comprehensive basis what those issues are. That's why I brought in Atticus to be able to look at those red signal violations, say what are the physiological aspects that are making these people do that, and then give them the training to do that. And I've talked about the tools for the job. You know, the most engaged workforce is one that has is respected and has the tools to be able to do the job. That's one of the first things that you need to do. And that includes training. And it includes the right training. So it's not only giving them the hammer to use, but it's teaching them how to use the hammer and how to use that safely. And training is a large component of that. And one of the biggest components in which Ms. Moore McGee and I are working on is those first level supervision. That first level supervision, that has to be your absolutely most engaged workforce. That is where you're going to be able to catch those people, where they're going to be able to change those behaviors. They have the most direct influence on those people's behaviors. And it's important that they understand how to manage, not just manage the technical work, but manage the personalities of the various personalities that they deal with out there, you know, which is very, very difficult. They go from very, very highly technical people, which you need, all of a sudden going into the supervisory role. So it's important. That's one of the biggest things that we have to do is that frontline supervision. They're most engaged with those people that, like you said, are the ones that can, you know, can falter and make a mistake. They're the ones that we really have to get to, have to be able to work in high at very, very high performance. We need to give them the tool to be able to do that.
Does this kind of a survey enable you to focus on those folks that you want to focus on for safety purposes?
This is a great survey. This gives a lot of information to us. When we see things like, I know how to report a safety issue. 91% know how to report a safety issue. 68% that you're not going to do anything about it. That's concerning to me. That's a problem to me. That says, you know what, we got people reporting, but 68% of those are saying, well, I don't believe you're going to do anything. Again, that's where that first level supervision needs to be able to be empowered to be able to make those changes that are necessary. So the data that I get absolutely defines where we can get to with being able to do that. And that's one of the biggest things that I see is getting those frontline supervisors well trained. We've got great people out there, don't get me wrong. We've got highly skilled technical people, but we need to do a better job of training them how to be leaders and managers in the work that they do, because that's difficult. That's the psychology. You know, the technical training is actually the easy part. It's the psychology of being able to work with multiple personalities and get the best out of those people.
Yes, Glenn.
Just a question for Tanya and Dr. Grittemeyer. On the cover of the survey, you indicate the three lines of business, rail, metro bus, and metro access. The question is, who in Metro Access, which of those employees were interviewed as part of the employee union survey?
The ones who are actually WMATA employees, the contractors were not. Contractors are not a part of the survey.
So none of the Metro Access drivers or dispatchers were included in this employee survey?
No.
Since those are our frontline people dealing with the disabled community, I would suggest that when we do this again, next time, you figure out some way to make sure that those frontline employees, the drivers, and the dispatchers are part of the survey. It sort of presents an uneven picture of what the authority provides if we don't get a sense of how those employees are being perceived by our customers.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Tony.
I think it would be a great idea.
I do.
Any further?
No. You highlighted a couple of the ups and downs between 2012 and 2014. What was the total? You know what I mean? Like, how do we do in 2012 versus 2014 as a whole?
So statistically, there were mostly stable performance in the trend data, with a couple of meaningful improvements, specifically in the resources and pain benefits categories. So I'd say overall, the assessment is you have sustained your levels of various attributes of the work experience.
And I'll just kind of chime in on that. A part of what happened between 2012 and 2013, why you see confidence in leadership and some of those other things that haven't moved all that much, it's taken us a while to put some of the programs that are now online, such as succession planning, the leadership development. It's taken us some time after listening to them, what's not there, talking to our colleagues across the organization. So those things are coming online now. We certainly expect and hope that there will be significant change in the next survey.
Yep, and just to follow up to that, is that, do you have any goals or anything that you're working towards for the 2016 that you're looking to accomplish?
Well, we're certainly looking to move the needle in confidence in leadership and communication, open and honest communication, as well as collaboration and work processes and customer service. We're looking to see improvement in those numbers.
Okay. Anything further? Okay, great. Thank you very much. Our next presentation.
I'm Blair Fishman, the Deputy Chief Financial Officer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. As in the past, the objectives for this presentation are to give the board a brief financial update with respect to grants management status and also present the monthly progress status against our committed corrective action plans associated with the FPA's FMO report. And this month's FMO reporting includes progress through the end of August. For a financial update, our total federal grant draws since the March 2014 ECHO drawdown restriction was imposed now total $392 million. Through August 31st, the first 2 months of fiscal year 2016, we've received $17 million in grant reimbursements. Currently, there's approximately $45 million of submitted draw requests under review. As of the end of August, WMATA has reduced its outstanding short-term debt by 47%, this will be since May 1st, from $503 million to $269 million. This includes making $150 million in payments on our grant anticipation notes, leaving a $50 million outstanding balance of the original $200 million issued, and paying down $84 million on our lines of credit with $219 million currently drawn. The U.S. bank line of credit for $75 million was extended for another 90 days due to expire August 31st. It was extended for 90 days through November 30th. And during that time, we were negotiating actually a 12-month extension with U.S. Bank, which they've expressed a willingness to do for us. Our $220 million Series 2015 debt issuance timing will be dependent upon completion of release of our fiscal year 2015 audited financial statements. In the meantime, we remain on track to fully repay our Series 2014 grant anticipation notes in October. And lastly, assuming we sustain sufficient levels of federal grant reimbursements in fiscal year 2016, we project paying down line of credit balances of $55 million in the first half and $50 million in the second half. Our FMO summary timeline recaps the major milestone dates of the corrective action plans we submitted, the follow-up requests we received, and the submissions we've made that satisfy those follow-up requests. This includes FPA's August 4th request for additional backup and detail that supported our June 30th submission of cost reconciliations on those remaining FMO-related aged open grants. Last Friday, on September 4th, we submitted our evidential documentation to satisfy FDA's August 4th request on time for their requested due date. With all the FMO CAP submissions now complete, with their internal compliance office in the early stages of developing a web-based training program for FMO-related employee education in the areas of grants management, asset management, and procurement, we've removed two of the FMO dashboard charts while we continue to keep track two of the original four. The quality of or acceptance level of our manually submitted drawdown packages has been retained, as well as the number of FMO recommendations we've fulfilled based on corrective action plan submissions and the FDA's confirmation of their adequacy. Our manual draw submission package quality metrics chart track the success and or approval rate of both individual package submissions as well as the total cumulative dollar amounts of manual draw submissions since the imposition of the ECHO draw restriction in late March of 2014. In August, the two FDA approvals of our submissions were 100%, and our cumulative manual reimbursement success rate through August remains at 99%. The second of our retained dashboard charts reflects the number of CAPs submitted against the 9 material weakness and significant deficiency findings, and the number of FMO report recommendations within those findings that our corrective action plan submissions have been deemed by FDA as having been adequately fulfilled. FMO findings that have been 100% fulfilled are highlighted in green, and the recommendations still requiring confirmation of corrective action plans that we submitted on June 30th and acceptance of the requested follow-up detail that we submitted on September 4th are for budget controls and cash and grants management controls. As previously mentioned, we submitted information to satisfy FDA's latest follow-up request, and we're awaiting their feedback confirming its adequacy. In the meantime, our Office of Internal Compliance has expanded their FMO CAP self-certification reviews to include the areas of asset management of FDA-funded assets and access controls over Metro's financial management system. I'd like to close by reviewing our next steps. We're preparing for on-site FDA validation reviews of our FMO corrective action plans implementation. These reviews have yet to be formally scheduled. In the upcoming weeks and months, we'll be focusing on the activities for completing the drawdowns of the incurred costs associated with the recently reconciled open grants that were cited in the FMO report. Our internal compliance staff will continue to conduct follow-up reviews and control certification to help ensure sustained compliance with our FMO-related corrective action plans and to help further strengthen internal financial management controls. Reviews of our labor drawdown requests continue to be conducted by our Office of Internal Compliance. Mr. Chairman, that concludes this month's FMO update report. At this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you for your report. Harry.
Thank you very much. I know we had a presentation this morning about the audit results, and I know that those audit results included 4 material weaknesses and 5 significant deficiencies associated with the 2014 audit. And the FMO report also identified 9 material weaknesses and significant deficiencies. Could you go back to the dashboard chart and just do a quick crosswalk and what you think has already been addressed and resolved going forward that we would be seeing in 15, even though they were identified in our 14 financials, if any?
I would say that the FDA-funded assets would be an area that would match up with the single audit findings. Certainly the budget controls and cash and grants management controls are big items, big issues. And then improving the federal financial reporting, ensuring that the FFRs and our schedule of expenditures and financial awards tie out. The fourth quarter report for the FFRs and the full year report for the CFO.
Questions? Anyone else?
Blair, thanks for the report on the slide titled Financial Update. First bullet says grant FDA grant draws total $392 million. Is that draw the monies that we've received?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. So what's outstanding then? As what's the backlog that we're still trying to eat?
We've submitted, they have under review about $45 million. We have probably as much as, including our new
portion,
our new grants that are still to be awarded, the applications have been submitted. We have approximately $500 million to spend. And now a good portion of that are from the FMO and prior time period. That's the $150 million I was alluding to there. So there's, you know, we have another $500 million of expense incurred, and we have, I think, about $700 million of awarded grants. withdraw that motion.
Okay, so we have the old grant money, and then we've got additive.
This is federal fiscal year 13.
It seems to me that number never really goes down because we are adding new monies to it as we get new apportionments from Federal Transit Administration, right?
Right, and then also as we put our new applications and their new awards, then additional pools of expense that we've already spent actually become eligible for reimbursement. We just submitted them. And we're waiting for those applications to be awarded.
All right. Keep it up. Thank you.
No, Tom's question is a good one, so now that you raised it, I still don't understand the answer. So, when I first got here, we had a lot of money that was owed to us, but we couldn't collect it, and I'm simplifying this greatly, but we couldn't collect it because we couldn't get the right papers to the FTA, like the timesheets or something like that. And the number seemed to be in the $400 or $500 million range. Now, that's what we want to focus on, not anything new that we submit the right papers and got the money back or that we're about to get the money back and doing everything right. So go back to the $500 million-plus that was owed to us that we could not get because we weren't submitting the right papers, but we were trying to get it because we were going to actually submit the right papers. So that's very simplistic, but you got the gist of what I'm trying to talk about. How much, right? How much are we still owed that we haven't been able to submit the right papers for? So it would be prior to 2014, I think.
Of the pre-draw restriction, we probably have about $285 million.
Okay. So it's $285 million of money that is owed to us, but we can't get it because we haven't submitted the right papers.
Yes, and a lot of that also is the labor, charges that we're going to go back and kind of reconstruct the justifications for and the associations for the project.
Now, is that our intent? Now, I remember early on that there was comments that we may never be able to get it, and then there were comments that we actually might be able to get it. Where are we in? Might be able to get how much of that 285?
So, about 150 of that 285 related to timesheets that are not available. They are not available. We were not signing timesheets at the time. And so,
unlikely we'll be able to get.
Well, I mean, we continue to talk to FTA, and they continue to look for opportunities and options for addressing that. There has not been any movement on that at this point.
Okay. Corbett, you got some?
Yeah, in terms of following up on it, Dennis, there's a certain portion of funds that we may not ever get. I wouldn't characterize it that way. What percentage of funds that are out there we're having difficulty getting the necessary paperwork to reconcile?
At this point, we believe that portion of the reimbursements related to timesheets that are not available is the most problematic portion of the potential reimbursements.
What's the value of that?
About $150 million. Okay. That said, we believe that based on the reviews that the FTA's FMO have done that indicates that there are sufficient controls around how Metro deploys labor should be adequate justification for seeking those reimbursements. That said, no decisions have been made by FTA or OMB, but you know, that's something that we believe strongly that we should be able to get reimbursement.
So in essence, we're requesting an exception.
That's correct.
Because of the inability to
documentation.
What about around the construction component of it as well?
Well, the rest of the expenses obviously relates to the construction side, whether with respect to either materials, some of which may be tied with respect to Buy America, and we've made significant progress on that, all with respect to consultants. We are going through those we do not believe have the same challenges.
Sure.
It's simply a question of going through the process, identifying all of the records, getting FTA to review them, and then make a decision.
but that we are a lot more confident about compared to the timesheets.
Okay, thank you. The exception, Dennis, would be I'll be very short. The exception would be the way we were submitting timesheet in the past versus, you know, manual timesheets that they're asking for now.
The exception would be the absence of signed
timesheets. Okay.
Just so that I understand, has it always been the requirement that they be signed timesheets, and this is a change, or did they change their requirement? Just for an understanding.
There has always been a requirement of signed timesheets.
So was this the first time that they audited that and found that the timesheets were not being signed, or did we stop signing timesheets, or?
I wish I could answer that question. I mean, this is the first time AFTA identified this set of issues. I will tell you that internally, this is not a case of first instance.
This actually predates this.
With respect to those items that are still being dealt with, which therefore means there's some federal money that isn't being drawn, do we have any contingency plans for how we might reprogram to resolve these issues?
If you recall, the answer is yes, obviously. And if you also recall, this is precisely the reason why Metro borrowed $500 million, to cover these outstanding obligations. So we've made some efforts in terms of paying some of them down. And to FTA's credit, they have made significant progress in terms of both the speed and the scope of reimbursement. Correct. And they have been extremely helpful in getting some of the funds back to us. But some of these issues go beyond FTA, as I've indicated to this board. And at some point, we may need all of your help in getting the appropriate individuals to help make the right decisions.
Which is the question I was just going to ask. You're the head federal rep. What do we do to go to the... I mean, Dennis just made, to me, a compelling case. We should get $150 million, but needs help to get them, because he said there's no movement. So what do we do to do that?
Our approach to date has been to be sure we really have got all other avenues closed off and that we can really make the best case we can, and we maybe have some contingency plan if they say no. They have every legal basis to say no. And one of the concerns is if they wanted to say yes, it may not be within their power to say yes, and they have to go to the higher level.
Okay. Maybe you and I can talk after and figure out who we go to talk to. To the chairman and then the finance chairman, we'll go figure out who do we talk to see if they'll let it. Okay, great. Anything else
have
on this?
To have our house really good
sure,
neighbor.
I got you. Yeah. Anything else anybody have? Okay, thank you. What's next?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, board members. My name is Randy Grumman. I was the acting AGM of TIES for the last 5 months while the search was on for the new AGM of TIES, Mr. Andrew Alba. I'll be presenting the last quarter of 2015 for the rim update. Next slide. As of June 30th, WMATA expended 65% of the budget, or $717 million of the $1.1 billion budget. The following slides are some examples of various capital projects that we've been working on. Vehicles and vehicle parts, bus and metro access. WMATA has a bus fleet of 1,531 buses. The goal was to rehabilitate 100 buses in FY15. However, it was WMATA's first time rehabilitating five different fleets simultaneously. The fleet variety created larger than anticipated learning curve. The learning curve combined with some parts shortages resulted in rehabilitating 81 of the 100 buses. We will return to our annual goal of relocating 100 buses next fiscal year. We met our goal of replacing 81 buses this past fiscal year, as well as adding an additional 20 buses to the fleet. The WMATA received 120 of the 150 planned metro access vehicles. The remaining 30 are part of the next generation new pilot platform vehicles. The procurement of the pilot vehicles has been delayed and delivery is not expected until late FY 2016. Next slide. Tracking structures. Tracking structures completed 1,037 welds in FY 2015, falling short of the target goal of 1,200. There were several equipment malfunctions that contributed to reduce the equipment. 535 linear feet of the planned 750 linear feet of footing slab work was rehabilitated. The reduction was a result of engineering study that concluded the remaining locations did not require any rehabilitation. Track structures have exceeded the targets for sign replacements and rail pad rehabilitations, as well as track rehabilitation to include ballast tamping, replacement of rails, fasteners, cross ties, and switches. Additionally, track structures have repaired more than 3,200 leaks in the tunnel sections of the railroad. Next slide. Bus garages and other facilities. FY15 saw the completion of the permit process, the permit construction to commence for the replacement of the Royal Street bus garage. The contractor's work is actively working on site work, underground utilities, retaining walls, grading, etc., with the goal of having the earthwork completed before winter. It is expected the erection of the main building should start by the end of the calendar year. The Southern Avenue bus garage was part of the deferral list at the beginning of FY15. Upon receipt of notice to proceed, the contractor commenced with preparation of final design, which was recently completed. The contractor and WMATA are working with local utilities as well as the county for the required permits. Field activities are expected to start this fall. The test track project has three components: the test track, employee parking garage, and the commissioning facility. The commission facility was completed in April 2015 and the garage in July of 2015. There are some punch list items for each, but WMATA personnel are using both of these facilities. The test track is expected to be ready for its intended purpose no later than October. The new District 2 police substation was christened in December 2014, opened for use by the Metro Transit Police Department shortly thereafter, and the contractors in the closeout phase. The renovations of the three buildings for the Special Operations Center project was completed in June of 2015. A certificate of occupancy has been issued for two of the buildings and expected for the third very soon. Move-in is expected to commence. Move-in is expected to commence later this month. Slide. NTSB requirements. First part of the requirement was power cables. The power cable program encountered two major obstacles this year. The contractor, Fuel and Transportation, went bankrupt in July, and it took 5.5 months before the bonding company could reestablish a new contractor. Also, because of the Swan Plaza incident, we were redirected from replacement of the longer track feeder cables to replace shorter cables known as jumper cables. Jumper cables are cables that bring together two rail sections, a third rail, where there's a gap, and there's a short pigtail that connects the jumpers to the contact rail. Jumper cables are part of the traction power circuit that provides continuous power to the third rail to power the train. Vermonta conducted a system-wide survey of the tunnel above ground and yards. The survey identified 125 locations that required jumper cable remediation. To date, all 125 locations have been remediated. These activities resulted in installing 4,809 linear feet of cable instead of the planned goal of 20,000 linear feet. The second portion was replacement of track circuits. The number of track circuit modules and bonds to be installed were forecasted before the contract was awarded. Due to a delay in the notice to proceed, for the contractor, installation work did not begin until mid-November, and two locations needed to be deferred to FY16. The number of modules and bonds varied from location to location. By the end of the fiscal year, the team completed 150 modules and 187 bonds. Lastly, passenger facilities, elevators, and escalators. All 15 elevator rehabilitations were completed, and all 12 escalator replacements were completed in FY15. 28 of the 29 planned escalators were rehabilitated. The one missed the goal due to contractor performance issues. It's been resolved. The budget and total deliverables were moved into FY16 and increased the amount in FY16 by the 1 year. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time. Any questions?
Any questions?
I'm just not understanding. There are wide gaps in the capital spend, but then your presentation really doesn't go into that. So where's the $150 million for vehicles and the $75 million for maintenance? Because it's not in what you've shared here.
No, what I shared was just a snapshot of some of the projects that we've been looking at. We can give you a detailed breakdown of all the capital projects.
It's okay, there are some big numbers, like 150. I mean, there must be some large drivers in there that you can share that people can understand why we weren't able to get $150 million spent or this $75 million spent in maintenance.
I don't have that information. I'll provide it to you.
Again, with respect to the spending rate in the capital program, which year after year hits a fairly disappointing level, we budget $1 billion, and this seems to be about the lowest level of recent times. I was wondering how much of that was deliberate in light of the FMO and the ability to draw federal funds. Aside from that, was performance reasonable or not reasonable?
Aside from that, I think the performance was reasonable, but I think we can do, we can achieve it a much higher of performance. One of the issues is with the rail cars, the ability to deliver the rail cars. We base our costs on those, so accelerating, being able to not accelerate, but to get those deliveries of rail cars on time. Is important to us, because that accounts for a large portion of the capital budget moving forward here as we take delivery on those rail cars. The other thing is the facilities themselves, our ability to get out and do facilities. We had issues with adjacent to us with CSX to be able to start the test track work, permitting issues which may come up on those, being able to close out permitting issues on those, the starts of those. So as we work through those issues, that's very important. So I think it was reasonable. The level was reasonable given the fact that we deferred some projects as a result of the FMO, but we can do better. There's no question that we can do better.
As we negotiate with the region over the next several months with respect to the next six-year program, we really have to make the case that if we get the money, we will be spent.
There's absolutely no question about that, and that concerns us too. We're quite engaged with OMBS and those dependencies on what we can actually spend.
Mike?
Dennis, your fourth slide or chart, I think it was entitled FY15 Year-End Operating Results. where you show cost recovery rate of 54%. That's, there it is. Now, that's combined. You have the breakdown between cost recovery rate for rail versus bus.
Yes, I do have that. In fact, in the next presentation, we actually have a much broader discussion. But typically, it's about 70% for rail and about 25-30% for bus.
Okay, now that's the operating cost, right?
That's correct.
You also have the numbers if you work in the capital cost and show what is a more realistic cost recovery.
Yes, we do.
Operating capital cost?
Yes, we do. But again, I'll caution. I mean, these are numbers, and obviously, NTD uses this particular version of the numbers for as a broad reporting tool. But again, there's several things that go into these numbers, and depending on the context that's being used, it will simply be totally meaningless. But you'll be seeing that in the next version, in the next presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, when you get to that, will you also try to discuss what is the overall cost recovery?
Yes.
For that?
Yes.
Can I? Mary?
Thanks. I want to focus just for a minute, too, on the capital program. We've been looking at this chart for a number of years now, and it's nice. It rolls certain things up, but every year we have the same conversation when we get to the end. And I know this is going to be a conversation in the budget. It's just got to be. So here is a request for when we, which would be to go back a couple of years and look at our year ends and look at what the explanations were. I know for a while on facilities it was like 10 and 20% because we were in arguments about land use and getting permits and stuff like that. Those seem to be all resolved now. But I think it would be instructive for the board to understand why some of these categories lag so that we can make a more thoughtful decision about capital spend going forward, given where we've been. So I would just, I think that would be helpful to all of us. So a request for when we come back.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to piggyback on that. And I know that we are having this conversation in Maryland, which is there's a lot of this money that's being put on the table, and it's my understanding that they've rolled it forward, but I don't know that that appetite will continue if there's not a clear plan to spend the money that's been put forth. And it has to be an honest number and one that you can get close to at least. And I just think that it's difficult for me sitting here to hear you guys say that you don't know what those numbers are that weren't being spent. That's difficult. It's hard for me to take that back to my folks and say, because that's why I'm asking the question, because I'm going to get asked that question. We've given you this money, and you haven't spent it. Why should we give it again next year? And I think that we've got to have good answers for that.
I'm going to be contrarian here. Maybe you should ask MTA how they deliver their capital program when there's unexpected delays, delays in procurement, delays in permitting. I mean, this garage that we've been dealing with for a while is in Maryland. I mean, to get permits for a gas line or a natural gas line, I believe that's involved in it. You have to go under a freeway. So, you can't, having done capital budgets in my career, you need a midterm correction, midterm look, about a serious midterm look, and you need a three-quarter fiscal year look, and you glide that capital budget into,
a reasonable number, Malcolm, that, you know, either you take money away or you have to add, but you usually don't add. You take money off the table.
Just to respond to that, I agree with you, Mr. Bolger.
Yeah.
It's just, though, that I would expect to hear that from the management, to say that this is why. These are, and I've heard it. By the way, I've heard some of this. I've talked to Mr. Troop about this, and he shared some of it, with, at least within his group, as explaining some of why these things have been delayed. It's not that I haven't heard that. I'm asking to hear that here and then be able to have that information and bring it back to the jurisdiction.
Okay. I have a trivial question. I saw we were doing something with District 2 Police Station. Are there lots of districts, a couple of districts? Is there just one district? Where is District 2? Anybody know?
It's in Franconia.
How many districts are there? So where's District 1? Oh, okay. Is there like a map that has the district on it? All right. All right. I'd be interested in that. Where's District 1? Where's District 2? Okay. How many districts are there?
We'll get that. That's okay.
All right. Good. Thank you.
No, would you like that as a map, Mr. Chairman?
Would you want a map? There is a map. There is a map. So we'll have to get a map for the district.
No. Mr. Chairman,
okay.
One more. This is just a silly little thing. We keep hearing it as the Royal Street Bus Garage. It's Cinder Bed Road. Can we just change it?
What is it? The Royal
it's
Street?
Cinder, it shows up every time as the Royal Street. We deaccessioned the Royal Street. We've allowed it to be sold. The facility we're building is actually in Fairfax County at Cinder Bed Road.
Oh, okay.
So could we just change it so it reflects the right location?
Is it Royal Street in like Old Town or something?
It is. We got rid of the facility. We deaccessioned it. Yeah. Moved to Fairfax.
It's in Fairfax. We still call it the Royal Street. That's good.
We can accommodate that request.
Bit of nostalgia, I guess. Yeah, Corbett?
Yes, one last financial question for Dennis or one of your colleagues. How do we end the year from a cash flow point of view?
$20 million.
It's much more.
I don't have the exact numbers here, but from my recollection, it was significantly positive, above $150 million.
That's fine. I can get the details as long as it's positive.
Okay.
One other question. In terms of our accounts payable, how many days out are we in there?
I believe on the average, we're out about 60 days. Significant, obviously, at the end of the year, 80% actually 90% of the overall expense, overall invoices were within 90 days. Obviously, given all the contract issues, there are some that are over 120 days.
Okay, last presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last presentation is on the FY17 budget guidance. Typically, Metro's annual budget process begins in October with the goal of adopting a budget in early spring prior to the start of the new fiscal year in July. This year, the process is starting partly earlier, partly to accommodate the board's updated grants management policy, which calls for staff to submit grants 30 days prior to the start, following the adoption of the budget but prior to the start of the fiscal year. For the record, we were able to do that this year with respect to the grants, and for the first time in almost 5 years, we were able to submit all of the grants available to Metro before the start of the fiscal year. And that's something that we expect to be doing going forward, consistent with the plan that the board adopted. So today we kick off this process. And as context, and this partly responds to both the information Mr. Augustine asked for some time ago and that Mr. Goldman mentioned a little bit earlier, we provide some information on FY16. The FY16 budget is about $3 billion, of which 1.8 is operating, 1.2 is capital.
And of that, we've shown on this slide the distribution among the various modes, operating and capital for each particular one. If you go to the next slide, last year, overall, as you saw, for FY16, rather, overall revenues were about $938 million budgeted of the $1.8 billion operating budget. That, again, gives you a 52% recovery ratio. That level of recovery ratio, as most of you around this table know, is relatively high across the nation. What you typically find, with few exceptions, are recovery ratios much lower than that. But if you include capital investment, as was suggested a little bit earlier, the numbers change significantly. It drops from 52% to 31%. Again, as I indicated earlier, it depends on the context within which you're looking at these numbers, because it really does not have significant value beyond a very limited scope. But the real question is, what does those resources buy for Metro and for this region? Those investments, as you know, provide both direct and indirect benefits, including over 340 million trips annually on Metro Bus, Metro Rail, and Metro Access. Indirectly, though, those investments by Metro and for Metro reduce congestion and improve air quality in the region, and more fundamentally drive economic benefits and economic competitiveness. And as the region is beginning to experience on the silver line, investments in that corridor, independently of part of TODs, propel additional land values and generates additional tax revenues. However, despite the long-term values that the region investment in transit provides, Metro faces some immediate challenges in terms of service quality. And you've heard a lot about this today, so I will not spend a lot of time on this. However, what we're hearing from our customers, which is clear, and across the board, has to be the baseline within which the FY17 budget is formulated. So the primary goal for FY17 budget is to find ways to improve safety, service quality, and customer service, but to do so within the jurisdictional constraints that we know exist. And we do that, and as we do that, we also have to focus on other short-term as well as long-term liabilities, such as unfunded pension or OPEB, in order to keep those obligations from compounding. Finally, given increased congestion in the region, Metro has to begin to plan for system capacity challenges that are indeed contributing to some of the diminished service quality that you see today on the system. So focusing on the operating budget for a minute, the biggest challenge facing Metro in FY17 is divergent revenues and expenses. That divergence is led by flat ridership, especially Metro Rail, which is not expected to change anytime soon. On the other hand, projected growth in Metro Access are expected to continue. But fundamentally, as system revenue fails to keep up with expected expenses, other revenue sources, including subsidy, are impacted. And just as a point of illustration, at current service levels, a 6% growth in expense with flat revenues will result in an 8% growth in subsidy, all things being equal. That scenario, of course, puts significant burden on the jurisdiction. So, as the board requested a while back, we here provide a 10-year outlook. Just based on the things that we know today, this 10-year outlook shows the clear divergence of Metro's cost and revenues. As fares and non-fare revenues have declined as a percentage of total operating cost, jurisdictions have had to make up most of the difference. between 2005 and 2013 fiscal years, revenues and expenses grew almost at the same pace as shown on the left side of those the slide. 5% for revenues, and about 6% for expenses, making overall budgeting that much easier. Today, the picture is different. Revenue growth has flattened at about 1% each year. Conversely, last year expenses grew at 4%, and with long-term growth estimated at 6%, the result is predictable. If you take a look at 2025, Metro's cost is expected to grow by about $1.2 billion. That growth is expected to reflect the current trend, which means that labor costs will continue to represent larger share of the cost at 70%. When you add the expected cost for Silver Line, Metro Access, and just the energy cost, you are at 92% of overall cost of this organization, which leaves about 8% as discretionary. That's the prognosis at this point. So there are, of course, various scenarios for maintaining budget balance. Based on feedback from jurisdictions, we know that the current trend, which is represented in the first column there, is unacceptable and is suddenly unsustainable. A balanced approach focused on lower expenses and more revenues will result in a more sustainable level of annual jurisdictional support over the next 10 years. This slide offers several scenarios, and this board will have to choose at some point which scenarios must settle. In terms of closing the gaps, there are three options available to Metro that will not involve jurisdictional input: of increased operating efficiencies, internal revenue growth, or service changes. In terms of operational efficiency, the range of options will include both personal and non-personal costs across Metro. Just recall for a minute that Metro implemented several initiatives to reduce the operating budget in FY16, resulting in almost $10 million of reduction in the proposed budget. The agency is currently identifying additional reductions to ensure budget balance with respect to FY16, given the ridership impacts that we're seeing. But with respect to 17, the initial efforts will focus around the boardwalk and whatever recommendations that process will generate to allow us to reduce cost. That said, the current collective bargaining agreements expire in 16, and we'll have to refactor them into the next budget cycle. Based on current board policy, Metro will ordinarily reevaluate its pay structure in FY17. Should the board choose to direct staff to evaluate pairs as part of that process, staff will conduct that review in the context of current service structure and economic environment to understand expected impacts on Metro customers, ridership, and revenues. Non-fare revenue opportunities are also appealing. There are things that we should be doing and that hopefully we'll be proposing to the board as we go forward. Finally, as discussed earlier today at the Customer Service Committee, Metro has begun a review of bus alignments that will potentially redefine current regional and non-regional service network. The result of that discussion, among others, along with the support of the jurisdictions, could become part of the FY17 budget. With that, unless there are questions for me, I will turn it over to Tom to discuss the capital budget outlook.
Thank you, Dennis. So in May of 2015, the board adopted the six-year capital program, the FY16-21 capital program, and the FY16 budget that we will work on. That six-year capital improvement program totals $6.2 billion, with planned investment focused on critical safety improvements, state of good repair, and system rebuilding projects. that current adopted six-year plan will serve as the basis or the foundation for the development of the next capital program plan, the next 6 years. So basically, we'll be adding fiscal 2022 onto that base plan. Metro faces several really fundamental challenges in the formulation of the upcoming capital budget and the next six-year CIP. Most importantly, the need to identify, scope, schedule, and fund key emerging safety requirements. The need to achieve regional agreement on a renewed capital funding agreement to support ongoing investment in the capital program. The need to reestablish the investment priorities for the system and identify which of the more than $10 billion of capital needs must be advanced in the constrained environment that we have. The need to address uncertainty associated with future federal funding for the system. And, as was mentioned earlier, the capacity to deliver capital projects in light of the constraints and external variables that are introduced during the delivery of projects. The FY17 to 21 capital program will continue to focus investment on ongoing and new projects to improve safety and state of good repair of the system. The program will include projects to address the safety recommendations from the NTSB, requirements from FTA safety management inspection. It will invest heavily in the delivery of new 7,000 series rail cars to replace the 1,000 series, the 4,000 series, and the 5,000 series cars. New bus and metro access vehicles will be purchased to replace vehicles that are reaching the end of life, consistent with our fleet management plans. Rail system rehabilitation will continue, including substantial investments in track and structures, power systems, elevators, escalators, rail yards, platforms, water mitigation, and others. Metro will also continue the replacement of key bus maintenance facilities at Cinderbed Road and Andrews Federal Campus. And I think importantly, if no new funding sources are identified, there is very little flexibility in terms of initiating new projects in the near term. Given the size of the safety and state of good repair investments that are already committed and underway, and the critical nature of these projects. There are some substantial needs competing for future funding. Most importantly, again, the directives from FTA and the pending recommendations from NTSB. In the first half of the next decade, we will have the need to replace the 2 and 3,000 series rail cars, and there's 366 of those rail cars. Station access and capacity improvements at key core high-volume stations are not currently funded in the program. Also unfunded are buses to the Priority Corridor Network and the other Metro 2025 capacity and access-type projects, including the Roslyn connection and pocket tracks and crossovers and those types of projects. As I mentioned, we have the uncertainty of federal funding that we are confronting. We have the annual appropriation process for both federal formula grants and for FRIA funding. There's a pending reauthorization of the federal transportation funding. And, of course, in the next six-year period, we're encountering the expiration of our current 10-year FRIA authorization. The FRIA authorization basically takes funding through Metro's fiscal 20. And as I mentioned earlier, a key challenge, the capital funding agreement expires at the end of this fiscal year, June 30th of 2016. Absent a renewed agreement and funding commitment from the jurisdictions, Metro will be unable to start new capital construction and other projects. Existing projects that are underway and on contract will continue, but new projects such as the rebuild of Bladensburg Garage and some other significant projects planned for the out years of our CIP will be unable to start. From a funding standpoint, as I mentioned, the board adopted a $6.2 billion 6-year financial plan. It assumes continued appropriation of PREA funding at $150 million per year, as well as continued levels of FTA formula funding at approximately $290 million per year. It assumes the corresponding jurisdictional match to those federal grants, as well as jurisdictional system performance funding at levels consistent with the current capital funding agreement. The current capital funding plan also assumes the issuance of $984 million of long-term debt to support projects in the FY17 to 2021 program. And so, as I mentioned, this financial plan and the capital program plan that is currently in place will be sort of the starting point for the development of the next capital budget NCA. And with that, we can briefly touch on next steps. In October, we're planning to return with a discussion of ridership and fare policy, and to a point that was raised earlier, a recap on capital investment since the beginning of the CFA period, so FY11, and some of the history of what happened with those projects. A budget preview in November, and the GM CEO's proposed budget in December. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions, comments? Mike? And Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dennis, I just want to commend you because I thought this presentation was one of the most honest, concise, valuable presentations that I've seen from Metro in the 2.5 years I've been here. I commend you for that.
Thank you.
Having said that, I want to tell you it was like a bucket of cold water. I sort of felt the same way I felt after the first two Nats games against the Mets this week as far as their chances of winning the pennant. This year we're concerned, but hopefully we'll be able to do a little better in terms of keeping the rails and buses running over the next decade, although you haven't given us very many options. I did want to ask just a few questions because I know the hour is late. I just want to return to the issue of operating cost recovery first in your chart. Revenue and cost recovery, where you, I guess 125 in our book here, where you show that the cost recovery on an operating basis is 71% for rail, 29% for bus. I've got to tell you that unless you give us some numbers showing what the capital costs here, I think it's very difficult, after what you've said as well as what the national rates of recovery were, to justify a rail increase when, on an operating basis, rail riders now are paying 71% of operating costs and they feel they're getting a service which is less than satisfactory, less than what they're paying for. So I would encourage you to try and develop some numbers that show us what the actual costs are for rail as opposed to bus on a fully allocated cost basis.
Okay. We'll certainly do so. I thought, obviously, this gives you the budget. We will provide you the actuals. That was the question you asked, and we're developing the response, which hopefully you should get early next week.
On your 10-year outlook chart, where you show the 6% growth in cost, on the revenue side, I'm trying to understand, the 1% annual growth, does that include an assumption as to fare increases during that period between FY17 and FY25? What's behind just an assumption of a one-year growth in revenues? What are the assumptions that underlie?
The basic assumption at this point includes the or incorporates the normal biannual adjustments with a relatively flat ridership growth. So the change that you're seeing there are essentially coming from biannual adjustments in fares.
So there is an assumption here of that every 2 years we will enact a fare increase?
What we tried to do was to model the current policy. Obviously, to the extent that policy changes, we will modify the model.
And does it reflect any increased revenue or traffic growth resulting from completion of the Silver Line?
Yes, but we do think that both the cost as well as the expected revenues from
the Silver Line are both
That's correct.
One more number, and then I'll give up the floor. On the next chart, what's driving expense growth? You show an increase of 8% for Silver Line Phase 2. Again, what are the assumptions there? Is the assumption of six-car trains, eight-car trains, trains running on what headway? What's the assumption?
I can look for the details. The fundamental issue here, the key drivers here is the projected cost of delivering service for the Silver Line. It will be the same service structure that we have now, again, which will be some days it will be six, some days it will be eight. This is based on current information. I can go, if you want actual details, I can provide you with that, what that is. I don't have a granular response for your question.
I'm just trying to understand it because I understand the increase in metro access, but this one sort of stuck out as something that I don't really understand where this number comes from.
We approach this from a total number of hours. So the number of hours that we expected to provide on an annual basis on the Silver Line. So, I mean, that could consist of 8 cars, it could be 6 cars, but it was a total bucket of hours that we used to model that.
But this includes operating cost, maintenance, I assume, wear and tear to infrastructure that would result from the operation?
On the operating side, yes.
Corbett? Dennis, a quick read as we move forward on this budget here. It's not rocket scientists here. Quite frankly, this is going to be a huge gap.
That's correct.
And I have a number. And I don't want anyone quoting me on the number, but it's going to be very, very significant. I think the board needs to be, as we move through this process, it's going to require a lot of work and some very difficult decisions that this board's going to have to make.
We've tried to stay away from
you want my number?
But to talk conceptually as to what we're seeing out there. But you're absolutely right. There will be a significant gap. And depending on which solution sets this board chooses to deploy, those numbers could be moderated to some degree.
Happy to hear more. Happy.
My question is a follow-up to the development and the regarding the tax is 28% growth due to phase two of the Silver Line. And I guess the destination should be a little broader because all of the elements of the Silver Line are engaged in the other part of the budget. And so, are you not
duplicating? No. We know the bucket of hours that we're providing now in terms of overall hours of service in the street. We know that in 2 years when Silver Line comes online, there will be an increase in the number of hours for Silver Line. That is what we've modeled here. So this additional cost coming in, not reflective of the current cost for Silver Line service. It's simply for the extension, phase two extension to Dallas, which is not part of the current budget, right? Yeah, most of the other elements are there. So what we've tried to do is to... Right.
If
you recall, when phase one came into place, there were additional resources that had to be deployed to provide phase one service. We expect, with respect to phase two, there will be incremental need for additional resources. Just incremental, correct. That's correct.
Jurisdictions for new agreement have to be going through the federal government during this time period to renegotiate the $150 million a year. We have the Congress acting on the transit program. We really have to justify, and I've asked this a couple of times already and sent a couple of memos in, look at what we do, why we're doing it, what our rate of improvement of the system is, what our ability is to deliver. We really have to make the case on this, not because we've always been doing it, assume we've never been doing it, and we have to make the case.
Mary, then Malcolm.
When we come back and we look at ridership, then we look at kind of what's been going on there. There are a couple of things that have happened in the region in the last little while as we've been having to do more single tracking and stuff during the middle of the day, and that's bike share and Cartago, or Zipcar, whichever version you have in your jurisdiction. And with bike share, we actually have the control group and the group that uses it, because it's available in the district and in Arlington, but it's not available in Silver Spring and Bethesda and some of those places. So I really do wonder, this is something I'd really like us to ask our riders, is if our younger riders are in fact making these other choices rather than going down and sort of not having control, as opposed to being able to zip along in a bike lane now that we've all got more bike lane infrastructure. So I'd like to understand whether we think that is having an impact, and if we do, what we think the long-term impact is, because it may go to the level or the kind of service that we want to offer. Is daytime service out at the ends of the line something that's really important? Or, I just feel like we have to kind of think slightly differently. It's like saying, we're going to have HOT lanes on 66 during rush hour, and then we're going to let people ride free in between times because there's just not enough traffic there to make it worth it. I just am beginning to wonder whether the whole system needs the same level of service all day long.
Okay. Malcolm?
Thank you. That as a finance person, you have painted a pretty gloomy picture, and I get that part. I do. I would ask that since you painted that picture for us, that you share in this process what the 1% and the 1% needs to look like. Because they are hard conversations, as you well know. But there are, and what's clear from your presentation is that number is in personnel. I mean, you've shown that as being like the biggest part of the pot, and those are conversations that should be a part of the discussion. And I do hope that will be in these ongoing conversations. The other thing that I would hope for, and I feel that the operating side is much more fleshed out than the capital side, and just going back to it again, that capital side be as fleshed out as you have the operating side, because you really have done that job here, and that's how we can even say 1% versus a 1. We cannot do that, obviously, but we know from those KPIs that those needs are there. I mean, the capital needs are there. They're going to drive the numbers. They're driving people off of the system now. Okay, so it will have an impact on the operating side, too. So I just hope that you would give that same level of attention to that. And then finally, I would just ask, who owns the capital budget here? Who owns it? All right? I mean, I understand who owns the operation. I get that. I can point to the person and I can say, trains aren't running on time. Who owns the capital?
Most of the expenses, and obviously I'm responsible for developing the budget, most of the expenses of the capital program is had to run, obviously, Mr. Troop. But there are components that are buses and vehicles that don't fall in his domain.
I was just going to say, I own the budget from the standpoint of facilitation, execution. A larger portion of it is mine. That's my staff that develops sort of the framework for the corporate structure. Be able to do it, working very, very closely with OMBS on that. So the DGMO owns the capital budget, has obviously direct responsibility to a large portion, and then facilitates it through the rest of the group. So the development of the spend plans, the spend curves, you know, we make sure that that happens. So that's on there.
But is there an AGM that has that responsibility?
There's a director of CPDO that has that responsibility. The AGM ties, again, probably has the largest piece of facilitating that in addition to the other work that they do.
I guess all that I would ask is that it might be wise to look inside the organization and see whether or not this is an area that really should have a dedicated someone who is senior, like an AGM. I think that's something you should take a look at.
I agree with that sentiment. Part of what we're doing is developing the building blocks to be able to execute that.
I wanted to kind of give everybody my thoughts and the thoughts I've shared with Dennis so you know where I'm coming from and where the District of Columbia is coming from. And so my thoughts are my thoughts, and Tom and Corbett can chime in if you please, but they do reflect the District of Columbia's also position. We do not support fare increases or service cuts. And I know this board has a tradition or something or another that every 2 years or every some time period you raise fares. We do not support raising fares. I think one of the factors that is driving people away from the system is it's getting too expensive. And it's not only necessarily in the district, it's people who live much further out have to pay a fortune to ride the subway in. This is what I hear anecdotally. And it's becoming cheaper to drive into the city and park a car than it is to ride the subway. I think that we have gotten to the point where our fares are too high. What makes public transportation work is convenience and cost. And we have become almost neither. So just so everyone understands, I have conveyed to Dennis, and you know that, that the District of Columbia does not in this budget going forward support raising fares or cutting service. And secondly, Michael, in our discussion earlier, we support funding the unfunded liabilities. To the extent that this 10-year plan that we have before us today, which we're going to come back to in a month, gets funded and stays funded. We don't rob it to do something else. So we don't support fare increases. We don't support service cuts. I'm not going to ask anyone who rides the bus to pay more money to ride the bus or to find another bus route and have to walk further to do it. I'm not going to do it. I want the pension stuff funded, the OPA and everything else. The labor costs are enormous in this organization. Coming up for renewal, we have a habit, not a habit, we just lose at arbitration. Somehow we're going to have to get labor costs under control. I don't know if that's going to factor into this budget. So everything that I'm saying means jurisdictions are probably going to have to pay more money. Not probably, they are. Now, I have a philosophy, and again, this is my philosophy, and I'll just say it. Public transportation is not only important, it's critical for this region. We can't survive without it. It has to expand and it has to get better. Public transportation everywhere in the world costs money. It is subsidized everywhere in the world. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I'm going to preach anyway. We all have the robes on here. Why not? So the bottom line is, if you look at your jurisdictions, and the only people who contribute to the operating dollars, remember, is Virginia, D.C., and Maryland. The federal government doesn't contribute to the operating expenses, which they should, but they don't. So it's us three, our three jurisdictions, and we spend an enormous amount of money on roads, on cars, on everything having to do with vehicles. And I'm a driver, and I'm glad we do. But that's what we do. We spend a fraction of our money on public transportation. And the jurisdictions are just going to have to pay more money if we want to have a first-rate system. And Dennis, and I really appreciate you and your staff sat down with me and really put together a 10-year plan. In order to make Metro a first-class operation today with the add-ons that we need and funding the pension systems, we're looking at $25 billion over the next 10 years. Now, that's the number, and it's not unrealistic. It's not pie in the sky. It is what it is.
And I think it's our challenge, we as board members representing these jurisdictions, and I'm going to take this on myself, to go to every jurisdiction that's a part of this organization and present to the elected officials and to the public, to the extent I can get it out to the public, that this is what it costs. $25 billion over the next 10 years if you want a first-class system. And if you don't, then we're going to have something less than that. And there's no magic bullet. There's no anything in between that's going to replace that. If this is what we want, and this is what I want, a first-class public transportation system for this region, and that's what it's going to cost. And so we have to do it. We have to figure out some way to do it. And I think it's getting our elected officials throughout this entire region to understand this, and more importantly, getting the public on board to understand that we're going to have to pay for this. Now, the mayor's not here. I wish he was, Bill. He is the best spokesperson I know for the regional transportation tax. He never misses an opportunity to bring it up, and I appreciate that. Whether it's the regional tax, whether it's jurisdictions putting more money, whether it's getting the federal government that we transport all federal workers into the city and back and they don't pay one dime in operating costs. Whatever it is, we have to figure out how this is going to be done. But going back to my comments on this budget, at this moment in time, the district does not support fare increases, service cuts, and we want to fund the pension. Okay, that's my speech for the day. Anything else? Anybody else have? Okay.
January 1, 2016, you have 20 or more employees in the District of Columbia. You must offer the transfer. Offer.
So. I want to chime in with everybody else. You guys had a great presentation today. I mean, you gave us a realistic assessment of where we are, and that's what we need to have. Okay? Thank you.
Jack, you knew that, right? So I met with the DC, DC Chamber on Tuesday, day after Labor Day.
Yeah.
To give you a heads up, the bullshit.